Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for May 16th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, walking and climbing cost about the same for small primates. Awarding young investigators grants, how shorebirds eat by using surface tension, rampant tiger mosquitoes, and going to Europe to do science. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
It's intuitive. Walking takes a lot less energy than climbing. But for really small primates, the two activities metabolically cost the same. In a paper this week, Jandy Hanna and colleagues report measurements of the energy expended by members of five primate species as they walked, and compared that with the energy expended when they climbed a vertical rope treadmill the team built. The data suggests that the earliest primates were very small and could invade niches in trees without taking on the increased metabolic costs of climbing. I spoke with Hanna from her office at the West Virginia School of Osteopathic Medicine.
The study was basically about looking at the metabolic or energetic cost of climbing in primates across body sizes. And basically what we found in this study was that if you're a small primate, you don't necessarily have to pay more in terms of energetic cost to move vertically or to move in a three-dimensional environment than you do if you're moving horizontally or walking on the ground, as opposed to a large primate where you do have to pay a lot more relative to the horizontal cost of moving.
So in small primates, the cost is the same whether walking or climbing, but in large...
Surprisingly, yes.
Okay.
And when we talk about energetic cost, we're usually referring to it as a relative term in terms of the cost per unit body mass. So energetic cost per kilogram. And during horizontal locomotion, small animals, not just primates, but small animals tend to have a higher cost per unit body mass than larger animals. And again, this is during horizontal locomotion. And that's because larger animals have these energy-saving mechanisms that allow them to basically reclaim some of the energy they're putting into moving. They have sort of springy tendons, and they can store elastic energy and those sorts of things. Now, during vertical movement, small primates and large primates actually expend about the same amount of energy per unit body mass. And if you think about the basic physics of moving vertically, it should cost a given amount of energy to lift 1 kilogram, 1 meter. I mean, that's basic physics.
Right. You're working against gravity.
Right. And so it was not that surprising that we found, you know, the small animals and large animals expend the same amount of energy. But the fact that the cost of moving vertically in the small primates was the same as moving horizontally was the big exciting part of it. We expected their vertical costs to be much greater than their horizontal costs.
Now, when you say small and large primates, what sizes are we talking about here?
The study we did looked at an eightfold range in body size or difference in body size from about 0.15 kilograms, so mouse or rat size, small primates, up to about 1.5 kilograms. So that's almost an order of magnitude difference in body size, certainly not as large as humans. But when we refer to small primates, we're really referring to those animals that are under about a half a kilogram, so around about a pound.
And so how did your team measure the costs for a primate to walk or climb?
We looked at the oxygen consumption data. So, you know, when you're moving around, you breathe in air and you consume oxygen. And so if we can measure the amount of oxygen in expired air, we can then convert that to a metabolic cost. It's an indirect measure of energetic cost, but it's an incredibly non-invasive way to measure energy cost.
Does this have any implications for how primates evolved in the first place?
One, basically the main barriers that we have thought for years that have impeded the exploitation of early primates into an arboreal niche that involved more climbing and more movement vertically may not have been a barrier if you were small. You don't have to pay extra energy to be moving in this three-dimensional environment. And it also tells us that body size matters very much. So if you're small, you're fine with being in an arboreal environment, but the larger you get, the more energy you have to expend to move around in the trees. And it sort of reminds us how little we know about the barriers that animals face when they're entering a new environment. I mean, these data really do suggest that the earliest primates were small. You know, there are a variety of hypotheses out there about what the earliest primates looked like. Either they were small or they were large or they moved like this. but the energetic data suggests that in order to successfully invade this fine branch niche or this terminal branch niche that the earliest primates are thought to have invaded when they became the earliest primates, it would have benefited them to be small. You know, they wouldn't have to have paid any extra cost to invade that new environment.
Well, Jandy Hanna, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jandy Hanna is lead author of a paper on the energetic cost of climbing in primates. Read the paper in this week's Science.
I propose a relatively straightforward experiment. Just award them grants.
Alan Leshner is CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and is executive publisher of Science Magazine.
What young scientists really need to launch their careers is research support, but getting that support often takes a lot of time. Currently, the average age at which an investigator first obtains a regular research grant, an R01, from the U.S. National Institutes of Health is 42 for a PhD and 44 for those with MDs. The average new investigator funded by the European Research Council gets his or her first grant more than 6 years after completing the PhD. And that's often after the researcher has completed 2 or 3 postdoctoral training periods and resubmitted the same proposal 2 or 3 times. No wonder the scientific community is having a hard time filling the pipeline with young scientists. They're nearly middle-aged before they're finally able to begin their own work. While there have been many special programs to recruit and fund young scientists, none of them have seemed to work very well. In some cases, these special programs have worked against the young scientists' interests. In one recent example, universities treated the first award from the NIH as an award for those young scientists who could not get a real regular research grant, so getting it did not count for tenure. In other cases, the grants were just too small to get anything done. That's why we need to just award them regular research grants. It is well known that there are many more highly meritorious proposals that can be funded, proposals that come from both junior and senior investigators. And if we're so concerned about filling the pipeline with young scientists, then why not simply bias funding decisions more toward new investigators? This wouldn't mean bypassing peer review, but tilting funding more toward new investigators. Fortunately, some initiatives along these lines have begun. Last year, the NIH targeted a specific number of new investigators for funding, with over 25% of the R01 grants going to new investigators. That's the first time that's happened in nearly a decade. The European Research Council plans to award about 1/3 of its frontier research funding as starting grants. More efforts like these are needed, both for the current generation of young scientists and those contemplating research careers. Just awarding more of them grants would demonstrate a real commitment of the scientific enterprise to ensuring its own continuity. I'm Alan Leshner.
Alan Leshner is CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and is executive publisher of Science Magazine. You can read the full version of his editorial in this week's issue. When the phalarope shorebird eats, it snatches a small crustacean out of the water and rapidly opens and closes its beak. This is not chewing. Instead, the bird is using this motion to draw the water droplet containing its food up to its mouth, against the force of gravity. In this week's Science, John Bush and colleagues report in a paper how the shorebirds are, in fact, exploiting surface tension in order to eat, a discovery that has implications for small-scale drop transport and microfluidic devices. I spoke with Bush from his office at Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
We basically elucidated a mode of feeding in shorebirds. You know, I've generally been interested in problems in biology which are dominated by surface tension, and this is one such example. So these birds use surface tension for feeding. So what they do is they capture prey inside their prey, or these sort of small crustaceans. They capture them within droplets at the tip of their beak, and they then use surface tension to transport the drop towards their mouth. And it was pointed out by biologists that obviously these drops are rising upwards, so gravity can't help. and they can't use suction, so they can't just draw the air in.
Because of how the beak is shaped or something?
Basically because it's open, so if they suck air in, it'll just bring air in and the drop will remain stationary.
So how did your team go about analyzing this feeding mechanism?
So we noticed that it had been pointed out by the biologists that surface tension had to be involved, but they were imagining it like a sort of capillary rise scenario. So, for example, if you know, when if you put a thin straw in a drink, then the fluid will come up a certain distance. That's a capillary rise. But it turns out that the characteristic feature of this feeding is that they move their beak like chopsticks, sort of in tweezering fashion. And it's only through this that the drop moves upwards. And so we had to learn about the wetting property. So this is the extent to which a solid is wet by a fluid depends on the chemistry. So let's talk now specifically about water, because that's the fluid that we're dealing with. If the fluid completely wets the solid, you say the water is hydrophilic, the water will preferentially spread on it. In general, there's some finite contact angle, and it's the motion of this contact angle which typically resists drop motion. So if you have a drop on a solid, it will get stuck. A common example is raindrops on a window pane. You'll notice they will stick until they grow through accretion. So you can actually have a drop sitting vertically pinned against a vertical window pane.
So this tweezering motion squishes the drop out, and then somehow it's ratcheting upwards towards the beak?
That's right. Basically, as you close it, it's a question of the contact line. So you have a contact line. Imagine just a sort of two-dimensional geometry. So you have a drop in a wedge. As you close the wedge, both contact lines, so at the leading and trailing side of the drop, want to advance because the drop is being squashed. But because of the wedge geometry, it actually advances first on the inner side. Conversely, as it opens the beak, the drop is being stretched now, and so it actually, both contact lines want to recede, but it's the trailing edge that recedes first. So as you, in turn, close and open the beak, the drop moves in a stepwise ratcheting fashion, always advancing uniformly towards the mouth of the bird.
Did you analyze this in slow motion photography or something?
That's right. Well, we set up a, well, here's a nice example, I think, of iterating between experiment and theory. So we started with our theory, which was that a simple capillary rise scenario should work. And so we found that this would work if we used silicon oils, but not if we used water. So we had a nice theory or a criterion for the morphology on bird beaks, which would allow this capillary rise mechanism to work, but it fell afoul of reality when we made the bird beak in the lab. The mechanical analog of the bird beak, this mechanism simply didn't work, and we found that this tweezering motion was absolutely necessary for the fluid of interest, which is water.
So you created a tweezering fake beak?
That's right. So we basically have, we call them bird beak nose pliers. So it's basically, they look like pliers, and it's about a centimeter long, as is the real beak, and it has the same wetting properties. So as to say, water is partially wets the metal, and so there's a finite contact angle, so the fluid behaves on the metal almost precisely as it would on the keratin of the bird beak.
Now, you mentioned a 2D geometry model. What about length and width?
So we did look at actually the three-dimensional effects, and we did that through some computation, which was carried out by Manu, the first author. But it really has quite negligible effect. The essential physics is captured in a two-dimensional scenario.
Is this a feeding mechanism that's employed commonly among shorebirds?
Yes, there's been actually quite a bit of recent activity in the biology community looking at the prevalence of this mode of feeding, and there are a few interesting variants on it. One in particular is called rhynchokinesis, and in this, the beak can actually flex. So the beak is no longer rigid. There's actually a joint in it, hinged, if you like, and so this can actually further optimize this capillary-driven transport.
Now, you mentioned that you had tried this with other substances besides water. Is there something particularly characteristic of water that enables this capillary ratcheting to happen?
It's the wetting properties of water on the beak material which facilitate this. So these would be greatly altered by contamination through either detergents or oil spills. In particular, some of these shorebirds rely exclusively on this mode of feeding and so would be at great risk in the face of oil spills.
John Bush, thank you very much.
Okay, it was a pleasure.
John Bush is senior author of a paper on how shorebirds use surface tension in order to eat. You can read the paper in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, hidden diversity. Marty Condon and colleagues reported a paper that plants in the Latin American tropics host a wider diversity of insects than previously thought. The insect diversity had been explained as a direct function of plant species diversity, but using genetic information, the team found that widespread species of the same plant supported many species of insects, most of which were indistinguishable from one another by appearance alone. Read Hidden Neotropical Diversity, Greater Than the Sum of Its Parts, in this week's Science. The Asian tiger mosquito, with its bright white stripes, has been found across the Americas, in Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. In this week's Science, news writer Martin Ensering traces how the tiger mosquito became such a scourge.
This story is about the amazing rise of a mosquito species called the Asian tiger mosquito, or Aedes albopictus, as scientists call it, which is really on a rampage in many parts of the world. And that is causing some concern among public health people because it can transmit several diseases. It's also a really terrible nuisance. It's a very aggressive mosquito that can really drive people crazy.
So far, then, where has this mosquito been found?
Well, it originated in East and Southeast Asia, and its global march really began in the 1980s when it was first found in the United States. And from then on, it's been really one country after another. It started spreading in South America, in Brazil, and then in Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. It has been found a couple of times in Africa now, and lately it's really on the march in Europe. It has exploded in Italy, especially in northern Italy, where it's become a terrible pest. And from there, it seems to be going east, west, and north. People have found it in Switzerland now. It's in southern France. It's in Spain, in Greece. And it's even been found in Germany. So it's pushing its borders all the time.
What's allowed the tiger mosquito to spread so quickly?
Well, there's a couple of things that it has going for it. One fascinating aspect is that it has been really good at exploiting international trade, and in particular the trade in used tires. And some entomologists who are studying this mosquito have become almost like experts in the used tire trade, and they've discovered, actually already in the 80s, that there's a massive trade in used tires. So, for instance, used tires are shipped from Japan to the United States and from the United States to Mexico, etc. And these tires often have a little bit of water in them, and that's an ideal place for mosquitoes to breed, to lay their eggs, and then the tires go into massive containers that aren't opened until they get to the destination, and there the mosquito can have then a new option and a new place to start spreading.
Is that the way then to perhaps curb the spread of these mosquitoes?
Well, that's what some people have suggested, but for various reasons, governments have been very reluctant to clamp down on this trade or to regulate it more tightly. It's also very difficult because it's almost impossible to inspect every container, for instance. It is a pretty big chunk of the economy as well, and the risks aren't all that clear. So governments have been reluctant to do something about that. And in addition, this mosquito also spreads in cars and trucks. From Italy, for instance, it's been moving north, been found along the Autobahn in Germany, and it probably just hitched a ride in people's cars or in trucks. And that especially is simply impossible to stop unless you want to control each and every car going into an outside of an infested area.
Now, you said that public health officials had some concern because there are diseases spread by this mosquito. What are these diseases?
Well, we know at least two tropical diseases that it spreads. They're called dengue, and the other one is chikungunya. And both are virus diseases that aren't usually fatal, but that can cause really terrible pain, muscle pains and joint pains, as well as some other symptoms. And both are already a problem in tropical countries, especially dengue, which has been exploding the past 25 years or so. The point is, though, that although some people say these diseases can now come to, for instance, to the United States or to Western Europe, the tiger mosquito isn't such a very good vector for these diseases. There's another mosquito called the yellow fever mosquito, or Aedes aegypti, which is actually a much better vector and which has been spreading dengue the past 25 years in many countries. So we don't really know how big the public health impact will be. Some people actually say, let's not worry too much about it. It might actually be a good thing that this mosquito is on the march because it's pushing out populations of this other mosquito, the yellow fever mosquito. And if that happens, we might actually see dengue go down, they say. On the other hand, there are also scientists who say, well, this mosquito is so unpredictable, and it has in a few places proven quite an effective vector of disease, so let's not underestimate it. But the long and short is that scientists aren't really sure how dangerous it's going to be for human health.
To that, is the tiger mosquito a picky eater? Will it only feed on humans or large mammals, or will it eat pretty much blood from anything?
No, it's not very picky. In fact, entomologists call it a catholic feeder, and that means a general feeder. It can bite pretty much anything that moves, you know, from humans to other primates, other mammals, cows, rats, mice, and even birds or reptiles. And that is one of the reasons that some scientists aren't all that worried about it as a disease vector. Because if you, as a mosquito, go from people to lizards, for instance, a virus that only affects humans cannot be transmitted that way. So the fact that it's not such a specific people biter may actually be one of the things that makes it a less efficient vector. But that said, the picture isn't all that clear. A few years ago, there was a really terrible outbreak of this other disease I mentioned, chikungunya, in a couple of islands in the Indian Ocean, east of Madagascar. And there, the tiger mosquito was actually the vector for these outbreaks. And to give you an idea, in a French island called La Réunion, more than one-third of the population got sick. It was a really, really unprecedented outbreak. And when researchers started looking closer, they found that the mosquitoes did actually preferentially bite humans there. So for some reason, it isn't always this catholic feeder. And if that's true, it might be a much more dangerous disease vector than we realize. It certainly was in those islands, and who knows what it might do in other places where it's imported.
Who's monitoring and addressing this?
Actually, many medical entomologists have argued for some time that it's not monitored all that well. In fact, medical entomology as a field has been sort of neglected a little bit the past 20 years or so. Recently, there has been a great interest in this mosquito, and many entomologists are now looking and studying its behavior and its ecology, looking more closely where it's occurring. But on the whole, you know, in every country where it has shown up, it's come sort of as a surprise, and people have realized that they haven't been looking hard enough. And once it does invade a country, it's very difficult to get rid of it. Once it has big populations going, it's just very difficult to kill it.
Well, Martin Enserink, thank you very much.
Sure, you're welcome.
Science news writer Martin Enserink reports on how the tiger mosquito has spread around the world. You can read his article in this week's Science. Scientists within Europe are able to move between countries for postdocs, fellowships, and jobs, usually without too much hassle. But scientists coming from outside Europe have had to deal with different visa and work permit procedures for each of the European Union's 27 countries. Science Careers contributing editor Kate Travis has more on what the European Union is doing to lessen the burden on scientists.
A few years ago, the European Commission adopted a directive mandating that countries streamline the residence permit application process for scientists. The directive, commonly and mistakenly referred to as the scientific visa, went into effect 6 months ago. Last week, I spoke with Massimo Serpieri about the directive. He explained how it's streamlining the process for scientists coming into Europe for a job, a conference, or a short-term research project. Serpieri is a policy officer in the Research Directorate of the European Commission.
Thank you very much for speaking with me today, Mr. Serpieri.
My pleasure.
From the European Commission's perspective, what exactly is the scientific visa?
The scientific visa is, let's say, a familiar way. It technically is not correct anyhow. It's being used worldwide to define a set of legal measures aimed at simplifying and speeding up the admission and visa procedures and residence permit obtention for third country researchers coming to the EU.
Can you tell me what you mean by third country?
All non-European countries, so every country apart from the 27 EU countries.
Can you tell me a little bit about the directive that was implemented in 2005 regarding the scientific visa?
Yeah, the directive is the core part of the package, which is, for sake of clarity, composed of this directive plus two recommendations. The directive is about the setting up of, hopefully, a simplified mechanism where through an agreement between, let's say, a short contract between the third country researcher, let's say a Chinese researcher who wishes to come to Europe to do research, and the host institution, let's say, La Sorbonne, they agree about a research project And in this short contract, the host institution certified that the researcher has the necessary, the required qualification and has also is in possession of financial means to live in the country concerned, in this case, France. On that hosting agreement, this is the name of this contract, a very simplified, a way to establish relationship between the two parts, the migration authorities are, let's say, obliged to deliver the residence permit. Obliged, of course, provided that all the various security aspects are checked. Of course, this goes without saying. There are two recommendations which are part of this scientific visa package. But one is particularly important of the two, which is the recommendation on simplifying the short-term visa procedures. This is very important to underline that this recommendation is about not long-term residence permit, which means for to stay in Europe for more than 3 months, but concerns short-term visa to stay for up to 3 months. Just to take the same example, the Chinese researcher who only wants to come to attend a conference in whatever country in Europe to be able to do so without having to attend long queues at the consular offices, without being asked to produce a long list of supporting documents, letters of invitation or whatever documents which are very time consuming for him, her, usually, and anyhow are not consistent with the idea we want to give that Europe is open to the country research and then we welcome them.
What were some of the visa problems that scientists from outside Europe were facing when they came to work within Europe?
Problems are related to, in some cases, the length of the procedure. And, of course, this idea is to speed up through this mechanism the length of the procedure, which means also trying to simplify the supporting documents required to apply for a residence permit, for instance, or also for a visa. Also, the directive states that these people should enjoy full equal treatment vis-à-vis nationals in various areas such as working conditions, social security. So any risk of having a sort of social dumping, let's say, by hiring researchers from developing countries and paying him less than the national researcher for the same job should be prevented.
What was the European Commission's motivation for recommending that countries adopt some form of a scientific visa?
Let's say various, first of all, the great disparity, divergences between the systems, which is a weakness, for instance, in comparison with other, let's say, research competitors, such as, of course, US. In some cases, for one reason or another, we got information that the concerned research had to wait a lot, months and months. So this discouraged, in some cases, even good or young or senior researchers to come. The idea is to improve the working environment for researchers, so to provide better career perspectives, to facilitate mobility, because these are concrete ways to be coherent with the overall Lisbon goals to make our economy the most competitive and a knowledge-based economy. And this is a recognition of the key role played by scientists, researchers, for driving the economy, the economic growth. Let's say in a macro way, a sort of international competition to attract best researchers at the end of the day.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Serpieri.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was contributing editor Kate Travis talking with Massimo Serpieri about how the European Union is working to improve scientists' mobility into and within Europe. Read more about it online at sciencecareers.org. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to try to solve the mystery of the dying cheetahs. We're going to talk about how some female frogs talk more than they're being given credit for. And finally, how beetles may have erased some of the fossil record.
Let's start with cheetahs. Why are they dying?
Well, Rob, this story has to do with a disease called amyloid A amyloidosis, or AA amyloidosis. And biologists have found that up to 70% of cheetahs that die in captivity have this disease. So it seems to be a very big killer of cheetahs.
What's the disease do?
Well, the disease is a bit like mad cow disease. And Rob, you've probably heard of mad cow disease. And how mad cow works is there's a misfolded protein, say in the brain, that causes other proteins around it to also become misfolded. And this causes large protein deposits in the brain and central nervous system, which affects, obviously, motor function and eventually can kill animals.
Is that what's happening to the cheetahs?
Well, something similar is happening in the cheetahs. It's also due to a misfolded protein. But in the cheetahs, the misfolded proteins tend to accumulate in the spleen and the liver, and this causes kidney damage, which eventually kills the animals.
Well, how are the cheetahs getting it?
Well, one hypothesis is that AA amyloidosis is contagious. Now, you might not think something like a protein disease would be contagious, like a bacteria or a virus could be, but mad cow and other diseases like it have shown to be contagious. Animals can transfer it from one animal to another. So researchers suspected that something similar might be going on with the cheetah disease, but they really didn't have any evidence for it.
So they looked for potential routes of transmission?
Right. Well, what they did was first they isolated the protein from diseased animals' livers. And using this misfolded protein, they were able to create a fluorescent tag that would detect other problematic proteins that cause the disease in cheetahs. And what they found that was really interesting was that when they looked in the cheetah's feces, they saw a ton of this protein. So that led them to believe that perhaps the protein is being transmitted through the feces. And what's more, that the version of the protein they found in the feces seemed to be a lot more contagious than the version that they were finding in the liver. So that was adding further evidence to the fact that somehow the cheetahs were passing the disease from one to another via their feces.
So another cheetah might get it in its cleaning.
Right. When a cheetah grooms himself, for example, he might be picking up, say, feces from the environment. Or even when the cheetahs eat, if their food has been put too close to, say, where they're going to the bathroom, then disease might be transmitted by contact with the food.
So prevention is through sanitary means?
Right. So the good thing about this finding is it suggests that the disease could be prevented by just keeping these cheetahs in more sanitary conditions, making sure that their coats are clean, and also making sure that their food doesn't come in contact with contaminated ground.
Well, from the mystery of the dying cheetahs to the mysteries of female frog communication. I always thought it was the males that were the chirpers.
Well, and that's what a lot of scientists thought, too. When researchers look at most frog species, the males seem to be the ones that always do the talking. They tend to chirp when they're looking for a mate or where they're just trying to tell others where they are. But females seem very silent. They don't seem to make noise at all, except for maybe when they're caught by a predator, they might squeak. But they don't really seem to use sound for communication. But that idea might be changing, especially for a species of frog called the concave-eared tarn frog. And this is a frog that lives in a very noisy environment. It lives in hot springs in China, which have noisy rapids and are very loud. And so the males, actually, when they communicate, they use these ultrasonic chirps, which are able to sort of penetrate this noisy environment. And what researchers noticed was that when they dissected female frogs, these females had unusually large larynxes, much like the males do. And most frog species, especially females, don't have these large larynxes. So that was the first clue that maybe the females of this species were actually using sound to communicate.
So the researchers set these female frogs before an ultrasonic microphone?
Well, right. They brought some of these females back to the laboratory, and sure enough, they found the females were making these high-pitched sounds, but they only were making them under certain conditions, usually just before they laid their eggs. Most of the rest of the time, the females were silent.
A female fertility advertisement.
Exactly.
Presumably the males are listening?
Well, that appears to be what's happening. The sound that these females make actually seems to function a bit like a siren song. And the researchers found this out by bringing a bunch of males into the laboratory. They turned off the lights and they piped in the females' chirps over a speaker. And immediately upon hearing the chirps, the frogs jumped right to the speaker. And what was really amazing is they had an incredibly high rate of accuracy when they did this. They jumped exactly to where the speaker was. And this sort of accuracy in homing in on a sound has only really been seen in more complicated animals like humans and dolphins, animals with bigger heads.
For stereo location.
For stereo location, exactly. They have more space between their ears. It's easier to home in on a sound.
So why is it that the frogs are so capable of doing this?
Well, they think it has something to do with the high frequency of the sound. Because it's so high frequency, it somehow bounces off the male frog's head in a way that it actually amplifies the noise. And you don't see this with lower frequency sound. So the frogs, turns out, don't really need a big head to be able to hone in on this noise.
Are researchers going to be able to use this information?
Well, it sounds kind of esoteric, but actually, the more we learn about any animal sounds, whether they be human or frog, it tells us a lot more about our own hearing. And especially when we're talking about something like this, where there's a way of amplifying the sound and, you know, getting the sound to penetrate other noises and being able to home in on it, you could imagine that scientists might be able to use something like that to, say, build a better hearing aid.
Well, from the siren song of frogs to how the Beatles are erasing the fossil record.
Well, Rob, it's not the Beatles. Huh? We're not talking about the rock group. This has to do with insects actually eating dinosaur bones.
Oh, okay. So what's going on here?
Well, what's going on here is a researcher named Brooks Britt in high school discovered some unusual markings on some dinosaur bones he was looking at. And to him, the markings looked like insect bites, as if insects had been gnawing on the bones. But when he shared his hypothesis with paleontologists, they just sort of gave him blank stares. So he continued working on the problem for several years until he himself became a paleontologist. And he assembled a team, and they looked at about 5,000 dinosaur bones. And lo and behold, in about an eighth of these bones, he saw many of the same markings that he had seen in high school. And these markings are very similar to markings made by a type of beetle called dermastids. And these beetles are known to eat rotting flesh and also to even go as far as feasting on bones. And they've been around for millions and millions of years. So it's possible they were around as long as the dinosaurs. And indeed, Britt's team found that to be the case, that these beetles had actually been around 150 million years ago, coinciding nicely with the time of the dinosaurs.
So what's causing the marks to occur?
Well, what Britt's team speculates happened was that as dinosaurs died, these beetles sort of came in as scavengers, and they would lay their eggs in the decaying corpses. And when these eggs hatched, the hungry larvae would not only eat the carcass and all the flesh, but they would actually start eating the bone by the mouthful. And Britt's team estimates that a huge chunk of the fossil record may actually have disappeared because of these voracious beetles.
So nature's recycler is doing a little bit more than the paleontologists would like.
Right. They're recycling a bit too much for anybody interested in dinosaur bones.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into a story about how sloths may not sleep as much as we thought they did, how the four wings of a dragonfly helps it fly more efficiently than other insects, and finally, NASA is set to announce the conclusions of a long galactic hunt. What did they find? You're going to have to check out the site to find out.
Okay, Dave. David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the May 16th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.